The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On last week's program, we began reading an article titled The Legend of the Music Tree by Ellen Ruppel Shell. Exotic lumber savage from a remote forest in Belize is the world's most coveted tonewood. If you'll remember, the few people have a very specific take. You know, I'll go back to earlier in the article. What is certain is that the story begins in 1965, deep in the Chiquibil jungle, a remote and largely uncharted broadleaf rainforest in what was then British Honduras and is now Belize. It was there that a clutch of vagabond loggers scouting for timber happened upon an ancient mahogany tree. It took them quite an ordeal to pull the tree down, which they ended up leaving until a connoisseur of wood a number of years later decided to tear it down. And now luthiers, who are folks that make guitars, are seeking out this wood. And we're going to pick up back where we left off about whether or not the tree, they call it the tree, has any unique acoustical properties. So back to the article. Such enthusiasm raises an essential question. Does the tree have any unique acoustical properties? Slash, McKee Watts, and other virtuoso musicians believe that it does. But even their expert views are highly subjective. Each had their guitars built by master luthiers. So is it the wood or its treatment that matters? Like fine wine, tone wood comes from a living thing, and evaluating it is highly subjective. There's a good deal of variation with any species, and few, if any, rigid rules. But it's the top or face of the guitar that most determines its sound quality, and most luthiers use wood from the tree only for backs and sides. Forsland is an exception. He's experimenting with using the sought-after mahogany for the face as well. Generally speaking, mahogany tops produce an earthy sound that some musicians like, especially for playing the blues. But most prefer the sound of top woods like spruce, which produces a full, clear tone, or cedar, which generates a tone that's warmer and less crisp. Hawaiian koa is another favorite for guitar tops. It starts out bright and gets mellower and richer over time. Basically, it's a matter of trade-offs. No guitar is built to do it all. Still, I wondered whether guitars built from the tree can do more than most. Or is it really the stunning appearance of the wood that so many musicians and collectors find so alluring, whether they realize it or not? Chris Plack is in an excellent position to address the question. A professor of auditory neuroscience at Lancaster University in England, Plack is both an expert on the intricacies of human hearing and an avid guitarist himself. He owns guitars whose backs and sides are made of Brazilian rosewood and other prized materials. They are great guitars and beautiful objects and silly expensive, he told me. Still, it was not known whether instruments such as his were acoustically superior to those made of more mundane woods. Plack took it upon himself to find out. He and a colleague had six guitars built, varied only in the wood used for the backs and side panels. The top faces did not vary. One had backs and sides made of Brazilian rosewood, another was made of Indian rosewood, and the others were made of mahogany, maple, sapele, and walnut. The guitars were tested by 52 guitarists who sat in a dimly lit room wearing welder's goggles. Plack was not surprised by the results. Our conclusion was that the difference between the guitars was insignificant, he said. Not only did the guitars all have very similar ratings, in many cases, the expert musicians could not even distinguish one guitar from another. Given these findings, I asked Plack to explain why Slash and other top-notch musicians are convinced that exotic woods like that from The Tree produce an extraordinary sound. Hearing depends on more than what enters the ear canal, Plack said. He invoked the concept of predictive coding, which posits that perception, motor control, memory, and other brain functions all depend on comparisons between ongoing actual experiences and the brain's modeled expectations of reality. Tests of other types of instruments have produced similar results. Antonio Stradivari, the 17th century master violin maker, handpicked spruce trees from the Fiemme Valley in the Italian Alps, a forest so sought after by instrument makers that it is still known as Il Bosco Cesona, or the musical woods. Today, Stradivari's violins sell for tens of millions of dollars and are coveted the world over. Yet, when 10 renowned musicians tested Stradivari's violins against newly built models in 2014, most claimed that the new violins had a superior sound. What this implies for guitars is that the very appearance and cost of guitars made from The Tree and other exotic and rare woods influence the way musicians and luthiers actually experience them. Humans are not perfect instruments of analysis, Plack said. Perception is multidimensional. What we hear is greatly influenced by expectations, by other senses, especially sight. The beauty of The Tree's wood is undoubtedly a factor in its popularity, says Steve McQuinn, the owner of Pacific Rim Tonewoods, PRT. His company is the nation's largest supplier of wood to the makers of musical instruments, a sprawling operation based near the North Cascade Mountains in Concrete, Washington. The son of a forester who once worked as a logger, McMinn agrees that expensive, exotic hardwoods are no more likely to produce outstanding sounds than are the more humble varieties. When you get an extraordinary tree, say one with exceptional figuring, the sound matters less, he told me. It's the appearance that interests us. The problem is that coveted woods, like old-growth mahogany, are finite, and demand greatly exceeds supply. Jay Howlett, an amateur guitarist and who is a self-avowed chief evangelist of The Tree, devotes most of his waking hours to tracking down hidden stashes of the woods, in garages, barns, and woodworking shops, of course, but also repurposed from tables and cabinets. The proud owner of two guitars made from The Tree, he has sourced it for guitar builders and buyers around the world. I found it for customers in China, South Korea, Japan, Singapore, Greece, Australia, France, England, Italy, and many more countries, he told me. I found Ruben the wood he used in the guitar for Slash. But I know of only 400,600 board feet of the stuff left in the world, enough to build at most 600 guitars. And when that's gone, well, that's the end of it. Mahogany was once so plentiful in Belize that The Tree is featured on the nation's flag, a flag that also portrays two shirtless loggers, each holding the tools of his trade. This emblem offers some idea of how important mahogany once was to the people of Belize, and also hints at how The Tree came under threat. The great mahogany trees of Belize are severely depleted, as are old-growth trees the world over, especially rosewood, ebony, and the Sitka spruce. In most countries, these species are now illegal to harvest, let alone export. Most timber used for mass-produced furniture and building construction is grown quickly and relatively cheaply on plantations. But guitar wood is quarter sawn, That is, it's sliced perpendicular to the tree's growth rings to maximize sound wave projection. Because these slices must be wide enough to comprise the front, back, or side of the instrument, they must be cut from large diameter trees, generally from old growth trees. These are the very trees from which the most highly prized guitars are built, and this is no trivial matter. The guitar is the world's most popular musical instrument. Most luthiers are wise to this, and many strive to be mindful of the provenance of their raw materials. In 2011, Taylor Guitars, one of the world's largest guitar makers, became the co-owners of a sustainable ebony company in Cameroon. Taylor's website now promises that all fretboards, bridges, and other ebony parts used on the guitar have been acquired legally and ethically, with a commitment to a long-term sustainability. Several other companies are working to develop tone wood from trees that are easier to grow and harvest sustainably. Species like sapele, ovoncle, bamboo, Canadian red wild cherry. Ever the innovator, Forslin has taken this step further, using hempwood bolstered with carbon fiber and Kevlar to build some of his bespoke guitars. Steve McMinn has his own ideas about sourcing sustainable tone wood. Some years ago, he happened upon a downed big leaf maple he described as extraordinary, its figuring nearly as elaborate as that found in the finest Honduras mahogany. He cut sprouts from the tree's stump and attempted to grow these sprouts in tissue culture. Maple is a weed. It has a great desire to grow, McMinn said. But not this maple. This experiment failed. So McMinn and his team sought out the best fiddleback maples they could find, took cuttings, and sprouted them in baby food jars. He then transferred the saplings to a 100-acre plot, where McMinn hopes will one day grow into the world's first tonewood forest. If you want wood for something specific, like building guitars, you have to grow it, he said. Still, as far as anyone knows, there is only one tree, and those lucky enough to handle its timber take the privilege seriously. Forslund, who lives and works in the forest, sees himself not as the destroyer of an ancient living thing. Others did that long ago. But as the steward of the storied mahogany, the tree will live on through the beauty of the instruments he and others create and the music made from them. The tree was on earth for so many years, and it accumulated so much wisdom. Forslund murmured like a prayer as we admired Jarrett's magnificent new guitar. Our job is to keep that wisdom alive. Just a bit about the author. Veteran journalist and author Ellen Ruppel-Schell is currently writing a book about the eels of Maine. And the photographs for this, Vancouver-based Grant Harder previously photographed the capital of the Klondike Gold Rush for Smithsonian. Next, we'll jump to an article in the prologue section of Smithsonian Magazine, National Treasure, Mother Country, by Amanda Pertusich. Patsy Cline sported a homemade suit as spectacular as her voice. On January 21st, 1957, Patsy Cline made her television debut on Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, which aired Monday nights on CBS. The show featured agents and managers from across the country presenting the latest artists they'd sign. Cline's mother, Hilda Hensley, had pretended to be her manager to secure them a spot at the taping in New York City. Cline was 25 and nervous. If she didn't get a break soon, she might have to kiss country music goodbye. She had grown up singing in the choir of her Baptist church in Winchester, Virginia, and in 1955 had traveled to Nashville to record a few songs for Four Star Records, which later leased the tracks to Decca. But after a decade of hustling, including a few appearances on the Grand Ole Opry, and countless nights singing at juke joints and on WINC, a local radio station, Cline still hadn't found traction in the industry. By all accounts, Klein and her mother were extremely close. Hilda had been just 16 when Patsy was born, and Patsy's father, Samuel Hensley, had abandoned the family when she was just a teenager. Together, Hilda and Patsy managed to support themselves. Patsy also had a younger brother, Samuel Jr., and a younger sister, Sylvia May. In 1953, Patsy married Gerald Klein, but by 1956, they were separated and would divorce the following year. It had been a long road to the CBS soundstage. That January evening, Klein enchanted the nation with a deep, steady performance of Walking After Midnight, which she had recorded the previous year. Klein didn't really care for the song, but the audience responded so enthusiastically that it nearly broke the studio applause-o-meter. "Don't go away, Patsy, honey," Godfrey said after Klein had finished. "You done won this." Decca scrambled to release the song as a proper single. A few weeks later, it was Klein's first hit, rising to number 2 on the country chart and number 12 on the pop chart. It went on to sell more than 1 million copies. Country music was then in a state of transition. Rock and roll had come to dominate the charts, and songs that sounded too traditional, anything with too much pedal steel or fiddle, or too many lyrics about family and God, felt hopelessly old-fashioned. Beginning in the 1950s, the guitarist and record producer Chet Atkins had helped engineer the so-called Nashville sound, which smoothed out country music's rougher edges, relying on backing vocals, meticulous orchestration, and glossy production. Atkins was a divisive figure. Purists accused him of neutering the genre, but his efforts kept country music commercially relevant, creating space for pop-leaning artists such as Klein. As the genre achieved new success, country musicians dressed in ever more flamboyant outfits. Glitzy, often self-referential costumes had been an important part of country since at least the 1940s, when guitarist and yodeler Gene Autry began sporting a 10-gallon Stetson, igniting a craze for cowboy gear. Yet as country turned more pop, appearing on stage in some sort of glittering, extravagantly embellished outfit became even more vital, especially for a new singer desperate to make a name for herself. The whole industry was moving in a sequined direction. In the late 1940s, a Ukrainian immigrant named Nudi Kohn, born Nuta Kolteryenko in Kyiv in 1902, had begun sewing elaborate garments out of his garage in Los Angeles and selling them to showgirls and Hollywood actors, including country singer-turned-Western star Roy Rogers. Kohn's suits were gloriously ostentatious, with rhinestones, fringe, and leather patchwork. No degree of ornamentation was too absurd, and nudie suits became de rigueur for country stars. Elvis Presley appeared in an extraordinary gold lamé nudie suit for the cover of his 1959 album, 50 Million Elvis Fans Can't Be Wrong. Presley supposedly paid $2,500 for the piece. The idea was to stand out on a crowded stage full of orchestra members and backing vocalists, to convey unequivocally that a star was in the room. In 1958, presumably inspired by the glitz of Nudie's famous suits, Klein's mother made her a pink ensemble sporting record-shaped wool patches with the names of her daughter's singles spelled out in pink rhinestones. "Come on in" on the left shoulder, "Poor Man's Roses" on the right. "Shoulder Stop the World" on the left leg, "Yes, I Understand" on the right leg, and finally, "Walking After Midnight" on the back. Klein wore it often, including the following year in the parade for her hometown's annual Shenandoah Apple Blossom Festival. Hilda's creation is as spectacular as any nudie suit, perhaps even more beautiful for its handmade flourishes. The lilt of Hilda's stitching, the black piping, you can imagine Hilda beaming as she worked on the costume. Love is evident in every stitch. It shines brighter than any rhinestone. We'll move on to another article in the prologue section. Health, this time, The Unequal Distribution of Health, by Ted Scheinman. A new Smithsonian Channel documentary shines a light on medicine's biases. Racial inequity shows up in every dimension of healthcare, says Neil Shah, an assistant professor in obstetrics and gynecology at Harvard Medical School and chief medical officer of Maven Clinic, a pioneering virtual clinic for women and families. The physician lent his expertise to Color of Care, a new documentary from the Smithsonian Channel about racial disparities in health and how to address them. We asked Shah about the historical roots of these problems. You've pointed to longstanding deficiencies in medical education, including the lack of representation. Dr. Shah, yes, this has been true throughout the history of medical training, but even in 2022, it remains uncommon when you're learning about rashes in dermatology to see representation of melanated skin. Similarly, a common way to know that certain patients are unwell, perhaps they're bleeding internally causing anemia, is if they're pale. But if you're brown or black, that may present differently. How else has medical education historically contributed to racial inequities in health? There's the persistent, tacit idea that black patients are somehow biologically different. Medicine as an institution grew up alongside slavery. In order to commodify another human being, you have to dehumanize them. So there's the idea that people with black skin are somehow biologically different from people with white skin, which is simply not true scientifically. For example, there has been a deeply held belief from the time of slavery through the present day that black people have a higher pain tolerance. There's even a recent study that showed that many medical students still believe that black people literally have thicker skin. They don't. And of course, there are material and geographic barriers to healthcare for many people of color. The pervasive and infuriating history of redlining has had its effects on access to hospitals. In almost every major urban center in America, there's an area with the inner city hospital that is vastly under-resourced relative to hospitals elsewhere in the city. This is a direct consequence of century-old policies that caused divestment from certain majority black neighborhoods. So if you're a black person in America today, you're 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than if you're white, irrespective of education or income. In New York City, you're 8 to 10 times more likely to die, in part because that's the difference between access to resources for someone living in the Bronx versus the Upper East Side. You know that maternal health hasn't improved overall in the past generation. Why is that? A woman in America today is 50% more likely to die in childbirth than her own mother. When you look into the reasons, it's the same story that we see in every corner of America. Widening inequality is actually what's driving an overall increase in maternal mortality in America. What current efforts to improve healthcare for people of color seem most promising? A really important thing that I've seen happen in the last 2 years is changes in leadership. Like other institutions, medicine requires representation at the highest levels of people who share the lived experiences of those who are trying to serve. And historically, we haven't had that. But everything from editorial boards at leading journals to the leaders of top healthcare institutions, we're starting to empower the right leaders. And second, this is where I'm putting all of my professional energy right now. We want to use technology to get to a place where, for the first time in the world, your zip code doesn't have to be your destiny. It's not as though an app is going to fix healthcare, but there's an opportunity to use digital devices as portals into healthcare services, and that's really exciting to me. Next, we'll move on to a short Earth Day article titled Welcome Back by Sam Yadron. A hunting ban has fostered the return of a nearly extinct walrus. Strange as it might seem, the ancestors of walruses originally lived in the tropics. They followed food sources north and ended up in two main places, the North Pacific and the North Atlantic. A large group made their home in the Norwegian archipelago of Svalbard, where warm and cool ocean currents meet. Over the past few million years, walruses have adapted to their frigid environments, with long ivory tusks to protect them from polar bears, and thick, bristled skin with up to 6 inches of insulating blubber underneath. They learn to sustain themselves by using their sensitive whiskers to hunt for clams, breaking open the shells with their flippers and noses and eating them by the thousands. Sometimes they'd hunt seals, marine mammals to which they bear no close relation. Walruses are the last remaining species in a family called Odobenidae, a Greek name that means those who walk with their teeth. The walrus is like a mythical creature, says Colleen Reichmuth, a research scientist at the University of California Santa Cruz's Institute of Marine Sciences. They're like no other animal on Earth. Their closest living relatives are separated by almost 20 billion years. By 1952, Svalbard's walruses are nearly gone due to more than 300 years of ivory hunting. So the Norwegian government banned commercial hunting of these endangered species, and they began to rebound. In 2006, there were 2,629 walruses in Svalbard. The latest study, in 2018, put that number at 5,503. It's now common to see clusters of these social animals sunning by the water's edge. They fill the air with their cacophony of vocalizations, like friends chatting and singing late into the night. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.